So, how much are you worth? Hello there, and welcome back to Drat Veterinary Podcast. I am Dr. Alfred Tam, and today I'm going to talk about money. I mentioned last episode that money is going to be a common topic of discussion, so let's dive right into the root of all evil. Today's episode is broken into two parts. The first one is evaluating your worth. This is obviously a discussion about veterinarians, how much they are getting paid, and how much I feel we are worth. But these things are compatible with all jobs and careers. Number two is discussing where your money is going. So kind of our spending and where I feel things should go. All right, so let's move on to part one. Evaluating your worth, or knowing your value as a member of society. Now, the veterinarians listening obviously have a level of self-awareness and self-worth that kind of comes into play with a type A personality and perfectionists like many of us in this field. So I'm not really going to introduce anything new, I don't think, but let's reinforce what you already know and see if I might be able to spark some further discussion and thought. The ways I list worth in an occupation are the following. Now, some of these towards the end aren't really considered initially, which is unfortunate, and to a certain point, and to some companies, don't have any effect. But I personally find them extremely important, sometimes more important than the first few. So here's my list of factors that determine your monetary worth in business. Number one, your degree or your diploma. If you require prerequisites for obtaining a job, that should add the most value to your career. These are your master's, doctorates, medical degree that should absolutely increase your value. What's a bachelor's nowadays? A veterinary degree, for example, requires at least 4 years depending on your country, as some require that 4-year bachelor, and this qualifies us to legally perform a variety of practices no one else can do without this degree. If only you can do it, you're going to be valuable. Well, depending on the next quality, which is 2, supply and demand. Business 101, right? If the world needs you, you're going to have a job. If there is a short supply and a high demand, cost is going to go up. Right now, early 2020, the supply for vets is extremely high. Right? There's a national shortage, as well as vet nurses too. And the demand is higher than ever. So this is the reason for the recent boost in our overall worth as vets in the last, I would say, 3 to 5 years. Depending on how high the ratio of supply and demand is, all the other factors may not even matter, as evidenced by current events in the veterinary field, and I'll go into this later with some examples. Number three is experience. No matter what field you're in, the more knowledge and time you've put into a certain skill, the more value you're going to have. Even a child actor, though their time is limited, they're still an actor, and they gain valuable experience of their art and the industry as they roughly and intensely transition out of their niche. A veterinarian who's been out for 5 years will statistically have seen more cases, practiced various levels of medicine, and performed more surgery than a fresh vet out for 5 months. Let's be careful on this here because, as my last episode discussed, experience can be tricky because if your medicine is outdated, that can be a problem. We're solely talking about monetary value in today's episode, but having bad medical practices with even years of experience could put a damper on your hiring. Number four. So those are the top three that I think make up the majority of your income. As for these last couple, it's things that definitely add value, and although may not completely determine your income for some, I think it can decide whether or not you get a raise or continue working at your job. So number four is personality and work ethic. Are you easy to work with? Do you make others around you better and create a positive environment? Having a solid work relationship with your colleagues can make worlds of difference in how you perform and the numbers you generate for your business. Many of us veterinarians are on a production-based salary, which means the more money we make for the hospital, the more money we get. If we have little complaints and quarrels with our team, and we allow for good leadership that generates efficient work, you're going to maximize on your production. I believe this positivity should definitely add value to your income. Now, there are companies and businesses that don't see it this way, so this point's going to for sure have opposing opinions. But I'd argue that the quality of having people want you to stick around is extremely valuable and allows for job security. Being liked will also make it easier to negotiate a higher salary. Number 5 is location. San Francisco general practitioners are currently getting paid a minimum of $120,000 a year with production. This includes new graduate vets. All right, there are many, many who are starting at $150,000 to $175,000. Elsewhere in the U.S., you'd get a solid offer for $90,000 a year. Okay, location will really dictate how much you're going to make. Of course, there are expense factors, which I'll cover in the next part of this episode, but there can be a difference in nearly 100% of your income just based on where you're practicing. So that's 5 factors that dictate how much you're going to make. The last one will lead up to round up my whole discussion on the value in our fields. This last one, for some reason, can be the biggest game changer and is one I personally get very emotional on, because I've seen colleagues whom I love and respect so much not maximize this factor. So bear with me if I start to get a little riled up. The last factor is awareness of your worth and negotiation skills. You know, as many San Francisco vets are getting paid $160,000 a year, some vets in San Francisco have not rechecked the current market and are settling for $85,000 to $90,000. With the exact same credentials and level of work. So before I move on, I must acknowledge that this is all business. Money is an absolutely tricky and toxic necessity, and it can really bring the worst in people. As close as we may be and how personal we are with our boss or corporate hierarchy, this is a business. They are ultimately looking out for themselves and their family, and it is absolutely okay and absolutely justified. There are many people who will look out for you, and they'll do their best to make sure you get what you deserve, but there are also many people who will not. Do not bank on the former. Again, this is a business, and people are going to look out for themselves, which is what we also need to do. There's a way to do this gracefully and respectfully, while maintaining great rapport with your superiors. So first, it's important to know your market. The old stigma of not sharing your income with your peers is an old stigma, okay? I believe it's important to share this and not take anything personally as much as we can. I recently moved into a new field in veterinary medicine, and my colleagues are making more than me, and I completely understand why. But it gives me an idea of what to shoot for once I reach their level of experience and expertise. No one's crying to HR or heading to headquarters about what's fair and what isn't. And if things are really not fair, then you are not under the right management who cares about you enough. So if you find out your market and evaluate your qualities, your degree, your experience, your supply and demand, and you find that you're underpaid, then ask for a raise. I really, really find it that simple. If it's awkward, either you're making it awkward or your boss has created an environment where it's awkward, and both are not okay. This is your future. Your worth, your life. Take control of it and get what you deserve. If not, look at the supply and demand of our current times and get a job in the next town. I guarantee they're looking to hire right now, as of early 2020. Asking for a raise is understandable, or it should be. Everyone needs money, and everyone wants more of it. Worst case is your boss says no. Best case is they say yes. And the middle ground is either there's a negotiation for your offer, or they go over a reasonable plan that can lead you to make more, setting some expectations for both parties. So, we figured out your worth and we want that raise. How do we go about it? I am no negotiation expert, so take my tips with a grain of salt, and I recommend reading up on some books to get a good idea of how to best negotiate with the personality you have. One book I would recommend is the book called Never Split the Difference negotiating as if your life depended on it. It's by Chris Voss. He is an ex-CIA or FBI agent who dealt with hostage situations. Obviously very intense, but he does dive well into negotiations for salary specifically. So some points can be very extreme, at least for my personality, but it gives you really great insight into negotiating with examples of hostage situations, which is incredibly fun to listen to. Heck, this is the sponsor for the first sponsor for this episode. Check it out on Audible, which is what I used. What I will say about negotiating is that it's easier if the person you're negotiating with likes you. And that goes back to how great you are to work with and your overall presence in the hospital. Now, as I said before, there is a nationwide shortage of veterinarians. We have a lot of control of the situation, and I don't think it's fair to twist our boss's arms and back them into a corner, because again, they have to look out for themselves as well. But this is a huge card in our deck. Sometimes just letting them know, hey, Universe Pet Care down the street is offering $100,000 to their vet. Can we discuss my current salary and see how we can work towards that number? I actually unintentionally did this with my previous job. I had a great relationship with my boss, and we always talked about the business and his plans and ideas. He'd been looking for more vets for a while, and there haven't been any bites. So I started doing some research because I was already planning on moving to where I am now, and I found out his competitors were offering over 20% more than what he was. So I told him this, and he genuinely had no idea. The very next week, he decided to give all the doctors a raise to match that salary, and he updated his job postings. So sometimes it could be that simple. So that's my discussion on what we're worth. I think with all the things we put ourselves through physically and emotionally, that though money does not buy happiness, we should maximize on our financial returns, so at least money does not have to be as big of a problem as it is for many people. Again, we are licensed professionals who do things no one else is allowed to do, and it's hard work. Many of us have unfathomable amount of student loans. I can't pronounce that word, to pay off. Okay, we have a lot of loans to pay off, and we also have a life to live in the present and the future. So, with all that being said, let's talk about where our money is going. Part two, money allocations. Another note of discretion, I'm not a financial advisor. So take this with a grain of salt and really go see a professional who can give you personal advice with your personal assets. I hope my discussion can spark some interest to do so though. Now, one of our biggest payments for most of us is going to be rent or mortgage. If you're living at home with your parents or live somewhere where housing is not your highest monthly cost, then good for you. If it's not your highest monthly cost due to other financial obligations, such as credit card loans, I advise you figure that out as soon as possible and get it solved. I want to say that rent for Americans, especially in a middle to upper class area, upper middle class area, is around $800 to $2,000 a month, depending on location and housing status. So you might be sharing rent with a significant other or roommates, or you might be having a two-bedroom by yourself in California. So the next payment after rent, I'm going to go over kind of food and shopping. All right, we're very social creatures, and many of us love to go out and eat, or just eat. We also have guilty pleasures such as buying clothes, electronics, accessories, or traveling. These guys, together, can make up a pretty hefty sum, and in certain months can collectively be higher, or the highest payment on your account. Then you have your utility, your car, your phone bill, internet bills, and your monthly subscriptions, and those are all added into the mix. All right, so about student loans. My generation of veterinarians are averaging $200,000 to $350,000 in debt. Some are fortunate to have access to free tuition, and congratulations, I'm genuinely happy for and equally envious of you. But how are you paying it off? There are a ton of methods, but many of us are currently doing the loan forgiveness payment, where we pay a minimum amount, usually percentage based on income, every month for about 20 to 25 years. And then the loan is, quote, completely forgiven, end quote. I put this in quotes because though that amount is forgiven, you are required to pay what is taxed on the interest accumulated. Now, if you have $300,000 in loans at 6% annual interest, that will exponentially add up over 20 to 25 years. Whatever is forgiven gets taxed, and you owe that amount up front. Currently, our federal tax amount is going to be at least 22% for most of us, depending on your tax bracket, and will probably change in 20 years. 6% of $300,000 over 20 years is $662,140 in just interest. 22% of that is $145,000 you need to pay up front at the end of your loan forgiveness. What does this mean? It means that right now you're paying off a small amount per month on your loans, which is great, and it allows us to breathe and do stuff we love, but we need to put additional money somewhere to save up for what people call that tax bomb. And if you're a vet, you're likely in a higher tax bracket, and some vets will have an even higher tax rate of 6.5 to 8%. This can easily make that $145,000 amount go up to even $300,000. So do your math and figure it out. Again, see a financial advisor. The few hundred or thousand dollars you'll spend over time with one can really be worthwhile. Another good resource to use is the VIN Student Loan Calculator. VIN has a ton of different resources for us to use. It is paid, but not the student loan calculator. So if you go on Google and just type in VIN student loans, it'll pop up and all you need to do is upload your TXT or file that you can download from your federal student loans. It'll automatically upload onto the VIN student loan calculator, and it'll tell you exactly how much you're going to be paying over 20 to 25 years on the pay, repay, whatever system you want. It really breaks it down very well for you. I highly recommend checking it out. Okay, so we talked about rent and bills and living and fun expenses, student loans, the tax bomb. What else? Retirement. Some of you plan on working until you die, which is fine, I guess. I personally do not want to do that. I am an absolute millennial, and I want to stop working as soon as possible, as much as I love my job and my career. Now, 401, IRA, high-yield savings are some terms that you should know. There are a ton of other ways to invest your additional income, but these are some of the most common and safest ways to do it. If you are keeping money in your bank, you're losing money. I know it's an eye roll to constantly hear the word depreciation, but if your money is just sitting in a checking account, it's going to lose its value over time. I do have to stress again that I'm not a financial advisor, and I am not advising that you do any of the following. I just recommend that you look into it and really understand how it works. I'm going to explain my very elementary concept of it, but it's better to figure it out on your own. Depending on your work, you should be getting some level of retirement compensation. Try to work it into your contract. This means is that you put money into a plan filed under your work. Usually 401 is the most common. With smaller businesses, they usually do something like a simple IRA. And your job often matches a certain percentage of what you put in or your income. So it's free money. This plan is invested into the economy under companies or categories of either your personal choosing, or you can let someone decide and invest it for you depending on how aggressive you want to be. Check out Prudential.com. Investing always comes with a level of risk. Okay? However, retirement portfolios are designed for minimal risk and lower return rates. So when I say aggressive, I mean you can choose to put them into companies that have super high return rates, like 10 to 12% per year. But they can also fluctuate more than those who have a consistent history of, let's say, 2 to 4% a year. Okay. In addition to a work retirement plan, I would also recommend looking into a personal retirement, or IRA. An IRA stands for Individual Retirement Account. Traditional and Roth IRAs are the most commonly discussed. Again, very similar concept to 401, but you won't have anyone putting additional funds. This will be your money. All of these, including 401s, have a cap or a maximum of how much you could put in every year. So it's important that you diversify your investments. It's not typically smart to put all your eggs into one basket. All right, one extreme example is Bitcoin. In late 2017, so like 2 years ago, Bitcoin went up in $20,000 per share. People spent hundreds of thousands of dollars investing in this stock as it skyrocketed. And 1 year later, at the end of 2018, it went down to $3,000. It's a little bit better now, but that's just an example of how crazy one stock company can go. Obviously, there are people who invested in Amazon or Apple 20-some years ago, and now they're filthy, disgustingly rich, but we can't read the future, and that's the risk we play with stock. If you want to play it safe, check out what's called mutual funds. You've probably heard of S&P 500. These are portfolios that consist of hundreds of different companies that your money is divided into. So the investment company you work into, they'll research best performing companies and constantly change what's in this investment. For example, if you put $1,000 towards an S&P, that $1,000 is going to be distributed into companies like Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, Johnson & Johnson. And so essentially, you can see it as you've invested in the entire economy. It could be a global, or it can also just be the American economy. It's really, there's so many different portfolios for you to choose from. So statistically, okay, the last 12 years from 2008 into 2019, we've seen an annual average return of 12.86%. What does this mean? It means that in theory, if you put $10,000 at the end of 2008 into an S&P 500 fund, and you just left it there for 12 years, you'd have $42,705.18. Okay, someone please correct me if I'm wrong on this math. So the market has been great. It's been super great. Obviously, there are crashes. There was the famous one in 1920s, and there's also a big one in 2008. And that's why this is never a guarantee. But either way, the market has always bounced back since the stock market exchange has existed. Okay, and you minimize financial loss if you invest in numerous companies and not just one big one. And that term is called diversification. So if you want more info, check out Vanguard. Again, financial advisor, read up on some books. Vanguard is one of the biggest investment companies and are extremely helpful. My second sponsor of this episode. Some books, if you want to get more information on these kinds of things, is one called The Millionaire Next Door, The Surprising Secrets of America's Rich. It's by Thomas J. Stanley and William D. Danko. Okay, spark notes of this is essentially if you minimize your annual spending and you maximize on your savings, you'll be able to live a very comfortable life by the time you retire. One example is, let's say you spend $50,000 a year on living, eating, travel, all your expenses, and you saved $1 million. This allows you to live your life, your current life, for 20 years with the amount that you spent. If your cost of living is $20,000 as opposed to the $50,000, then now you have enough for 50 years and you can probably retire earlier and don't have to save up for the full million. Now, it's kind of common sense, but they give amazing real life examples and comparisons and it really opens your eyes. I really recommend that you check it out. The next book is called The Little Book of Common Sense Investing, The Only Ways to Guarantee Your Fair Share of Stock Market Returns. And this is by John C. Bogle. Okay, he's the founder of Vanguard. All right, there are many updated editions. It's a really, really good look into mutual fund investments. I also really recommend it. All right, there's more modern approaches to financing. This one includes popular books like Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert T. Kiyosaki and I Will Teach You to Be Rich by Ramit Sethi. They're much less dry on information and they're a little bit more entertaining because they have very good energy, but there is a little bit more bias and directness with how they want you to invest and be. So take that with a few grains of salt, but still really, really good reads. Personally, I also put some money into a high-yield savings account. This is not like a savings account that you have with your bank like Chase or Bank of America. It's often a company that works solely online, thus they're able to cut expenses on other stuff like a building and allow for higher interest rates. So someone will correct me on this description, and I highly welcome it. Your bank will give you an annual interest of like 0.03%, whereas a high-yield savings account is 1% to 2% or higher, depending on the company you work with. That's a lot more money that you get for putting your money elsewhere. So look more into it before you bite the bullet. Again, I'm not a professional. It's called a high-yield savings account. I also like to keep a 6-month rainy day fund. So I calculate my expenses on like my rent, food, and student loans and all that. And I want to save up to about 6 months worth just in case of some kind of emergency or what we call a rainy day. This is kind of saved between my savings and checking account. It's a mental buffer I like to have just in case. All right. And so that's a kind of a little bit of an insight on money allocation and where I find our important places we spend our money. I think it's good to see where our money goes and how much of it we make and use. If you want to try it out, if you were to try out a great tool that helps organize your spending and really kind of tells you where you allocate your money, the one I use is called Mint.com. They also have an app for your phone. I guess it's going to be my third sponsor for this episode. They're really, really good on telling, on setting budgets, showing you trends and categories of where your money goes. Okay. So this brings us to the end of my second episode. It's a little bit longer than the first, but something I find is extremely important for the survival of our veterinary careers and personal lives. The last tidbit is of this episode is one I've stolen from Eliza Schleisinger's podcast. For those of you who don't know who Eliza Schleisinger is, she's probably one of the best comedians at this time. Incredibly in tune with the audience and has some amazing jokes about our millennial mindsets. She's a total activist for gender equality and a fantastic role model for all professionals and, well, non-professionals as well. I'd highly recommend listening to her podcast. It's called Ask Eliza Anything. Her name is spelled with an I, so Iliza. And the bit I stole of hers is called Top of the Cob, which I'm calling Omasarcoma. So the top of the cob is the best part of your dessert. It's the crunchy, delicious part that gets all kind of bubbly and crusty when you put it in the oven. So the point of it is you share something that you currently are in love with or that you really like. And then you share the bottom of the cob, which is something that you currently hate or dislike. Often in medicine, tumors that end with oma are benign and usually don't cause much problems. I'm looking at you, glioma. And sarcomas are malignant tumors that can metastasize and just really cause a lot of trouble. So this is why this segment is called the Oma Sarcoma. So my Oma of this episode is Florida weather. Oh, I recently moved to Florida from California. I know. I did it for love, okay, and it was a huge step in my career as a veterinarian. That's for another episode. But I see places are freezing over, there's snowstorms all over houses, people are getting sick, and I'm here turning on my AC, wearing shorts, and getting a tan. It's a cool 75 degrees today, and I think I might turn on my ice machine. My sarcoma of the episode is Florida stoplights. Oh my goodness. Okay, so I moving from California, we also have stoplights, but I feel like the way they program it is just, you know, efficient or better. You know, no one likes traffic, but when you're spending 20 minutes at a stoplight at 3 o'clock in the morning just because they didn't program the magnets or the lights to allow you to make a left turn, it's extremely frustrating because, you know, I just did an overnight shift and I'm tired and I just want to go home and this light is red and I've gone through 6 songs on the radio. Florida needs to step up their system with their stoplights. It does not condone quality of life. And I think that's why there's so many, you know, angry and aggressive drivers here. It's the stoplights. It's the whole traffic system. It needs to change. Okay. Okay, so that does it for my last episode. Thank you all so much for listening. I hope I was able to strike some interest or reinforce what you're doing is right. So go find your worth, make that money, and retire comfortably. Okay? All right, thanks again. Until next time.